Thank you very much. I want to welcome you this morning. I don't know if this is true of all of you, but if I was going to skip a seminar time in this conference, it would be this one. Just for the record, I got the prime time because, you know, last night we went late and so on and so forth. And I'm curious, how many of you here are in a town that you would consider to be rural? I just want to know who I'm talking to. Good, most of us, because if you're a city person, I do not mean to offend you today, but we're going to talk rural today, all right? And I also want to pause as I look around the room. There are a number of you in this room that have heard some of what I've shared today and what I'm going to share today. And you just cheer me on and then hear the new stuff that we have to share. Because there's a lot of rural heroes in this room, people who have served faithfully for years in rural places, and that's an important thing. So we're going to just jump right in. The topic that I was given was how to thrive in a rural setting. And the challenge that I have is that I have like 6 hours of material about what I think it means to be a great rural pastor, and it all goes together. But I'm going to try to focus on thriving in the rural context. And before we do that, we just need to acknowledge something together. And that is that rural ministry is different than other kinds of ministry, and rural places are different than other kinds of places. We live in a different world, in a world that is often misunderstood. And this came crystal clear for me a couple years ago when I heard this speaker, Brian Garrett. He's actually an Assemblies of God pastor down in Dallas, which is a big town, but he is a minister who really values rural ministry. And he gave me some hooks to just help me understand what I'm facing. And I'm going to share them with you this morning as we get started talking about the challenge of being a rural pastor. If two people go through training for ministry, whether they go to one of our colleges or go to a seminary, if two people go through that process and they graduate, and the first one says to us, I feel that God is calling me to an unreached people group overseas, to this village that people have never heard of Jesus, we absolutely think that they're spiritual heroes. We put their picture on a little postcard. We send them around to all the churches to get money. And we put that picture on the refrigerator, right? And we pray for them, and when they get there, when they get to wherever it is, whether it's Africa or Papua New Guinea or wherever it is, we ask them to create a 12-stone church. Right? No, we tell them, learn the language, learn the culture, do whatever you have to do to get the gospel into that community. But if the person who graduated with that person says, you know, I feel like I'm called to Lamont, Kansas, we secretly wonder if maybe they don't feel they're prepared for real ministry yet. I mean, because you know the fact is that we all have 200 crappy sermons in us that we have to preach. Right? You know this, right? I mean, you have to preach 200 crappy sermons before you preach any good ones. So we'll send you out there. This is why you need to have Sunday night services if you're in a rural context, so you can get them done in 2 years, right? You don't have to stay there for 4 years. You can just get it done. Right? You know, because what we often do is we do not treat rural pastors, because the scorecard, we can't live up to a suburban scorecard. I live in a town right now of 28 people. I am never going to be a 12 stone. I'm never going to make that scorecard that a suburban church would have. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons that, you know, I'm even known is because we made some of that scorecard, just to be honest. You know, people started driving for miles and miles, and we would tell them that a church alive is worth the drive and all that kind of nonsense. But we know that rural pastors struggle with this because the scorecard is different. But I just want you to know today, we're not going to worry about that. Because that isn't my concern. I really did not go into ministry, and I hope you didn't either, for the approval of your denomination or of anyone else. My concern is whether or not you've internalized the inferiority complex that can come with not making that scorecard. Because let me tell you something about those two people. If that missionary goes to, let's say, some remote village in Africa, and they find a job that allows them to come in contact with every single family in their village that has children 5 days a week, they write in their prayer letter, "I have found some funding and a way to connect to the community. God is opening a door for us in this place." But a rural pastor will be in that school bus with his head down thinking, "John Maxwell would never do this." If my church would just pay me more, if they would be more outwardly focused, if they would do the things that would allow us to meet the suburban scorecard, then I wouldn't be sitting here in this bus with all these rowdy little kids and these... And you're like, just a minute. You internalize that. And then, having 5 days a week sat there resenting that you're in that school bus, you go preach on Sunday morning, you tell me that isn't going to come out in some way. And then you transfer that to your church, and you basically tell your church, since we can't meet the suburban scorecard, are you guys with me on this? And if you want to confirm it, you know, if you want to confirm that, just watch this. The worst thing that you could do for a church in that situation is for it to grow. Do you know why? Guess what happens when it grows? The phone starts ringing, and your pastor's gone. Right? Because we allow people to cut their teeth in rural ministry, or we put pastors out to pasture in rural ministry. You guys with me on this? And so what I want us to do today is to just realize, and so there's, some of you know I could go on forever. Is that right, Randy? Forgive me. All right. So what I want to do today is I want to focus on some things that we have to do to thrive where we are. And I want you to know right now who I'm speaking to, because I may not be speaking to you. I am speaking to people who believe that they're called to be rural pastors, that they're called to rural communities. And so the first thing that I think about thriving in a rural context, my goodness, I got this out of order. Oh, I don't even have that one there. So there we go. We'll go back. The guy who prayed with me, there it is. The guy who prayed with me this morning prayed that the demons would stay out of this stuff. We have to settle. I don't have this slide up. We have to settle. There it is. Settle the matter of calling. We have to settle that this is what we are called to do, and that this place is where we're called to be. And if it grows, and I start getting calls that would raise my paycheck, that doesn't matter. This is where God has called me to be. Because here's the deal. If that isn't what you believe, you're not doing anyone a favor by being there. There are rural churches that deservedly so have had this rotation going on because they treat pastors so poorly. But I can't help but wonder if you go back far enough that it started with them trusting some pastors that then as soon as they got some success, they agreed to those changes and they were gone. So if you're just there to preach those first 200 crappy sermons, at least have the authenticity to not ask them to make major changes during that time. I mean, if you're going to treat them as a stepping stone, at least be nice about it. But for the rest of us, we have to settle this matter of calling. And part of that is accepting that the scorecard that the denomination used to have, now it's changing. I have good news for you today. I have lots of good news for you today. One of the things I need to tell you, the scorecard is changing. The Spirit of God is moving in rural America, and it's being recognized by our denomination. That's an amazing thing too. But I have to just settle the fact that part of my calling is that the scorecard is different. The scorecard is different. And here's my scorecard. What is the gospel gap in the communities that I'm in? What is the percentage of people in the communities that I am in, that I'm ministering to, that are fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ? Because I'll be honest, there's no other scorecard that really matters. You see, when I started this venture in Lamont, you know, it was a little church in the middle of nowhere, and honestly, we went there because we were going to finish up some graduate work at Nazarene Theological Seminary. It was a 2-hour drive up the road. And, you know, we were just trying to balance through some things there. And then God turned that into a calling. But I had this idea that success, when I went into this, I had this idea that success was that scorecard of how many people were coming. You know, what do they say? Butts, budgets, and buildings. And we succeeded with those things in the first 5 years in amazing ways. And what I discovered, and I got to give credit to Larry Walkemeyer for this. He's a pastor out in Long Beach, a Free Methodist pastor who gave me this different picture of what a church should be. I started with this idea. My scorecard was a lake, what I call now a lake mentality. How big of a lake could I make? How much should I gather in one place? And that's why we had that inside language, a church alive is worth the drive. Because we thought it was successful if you would leave your unsaved friends and drive 40 miles on Sunday morning to worship with me. We thought that was success. That was the wrong scorecard. We built everything. I'm going to go down side roads. These guys asked me, "Do you have handouts?" I said, "Are you kidding? I have like 50 slides up here. I have no idea what I'm going to preach today." But you're going to get this. Doug, is it all right if I tell them this? Okay. We had a discipleship model. All right? Now this is going to hurt. Are you guys ready to be hurt? We had a discipleship model. We said a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ had personal devotions, regular personal devotions. All right? They worshiped weekly. They attended a home group. They honored God in their finances. And they had found a place to serve. Now, that sounds really good, doesn't it? Let me give you the interpretation. We're not charismatic, but I'll give you an interpretation of that. Yeah. Personal devotions, yeah, we do want you to be holy. Let's get that out of the way. Attend my lake, get connected to my lake, give to my lake, serve at my lake. And so we were like, connect, grow, serve. I mean, connect, grow, serve. Well, that isn't what God calls us to do. He calls us, the scorecard isn't how big my lake is. My scorecard is, am I transforming the community? And to do that, I have to go from connect, grow, serve to Jesus' command to come, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. Come, grow, and go. And so now we are trying to be a river, because lakes are beautiful, but rivers are powerful. And part of accepting the call of rural ministry is stepping away from worrying about that scorecard. And I'm going to contend that that's true for everyone else too. They just might not realize it as quickly. We're sort of desperate. We have to admit it, right? Because we're not going to get there. So I have to settle this matter. If I'm going to thrive, because I am telling you, one of the things that I see, I drive around way too much now. I see too many rural pastors. I love it. But there is this basic inferiority complex that comes out in passive aggressive behavior, in like a defeatist attitude or a resentment. And it works into the church. And it comes down to the fact that you're not happy where you are. And on the denominational side of it, we're responsible for some of that because we haven't honored you. You know, we just honor the ones who are with that score. And that is changing. And so this isn't a plug for Wayne Schmidt, but I'll just tell you this. He loves rural ministry. I mean, he canceled going to the New Room to come with a bunch of us to Rural Matters Institute. Even though that was a bit of a flop, he still stood in there with us and had a great time. And I mean, he cares about this. And there's this fresh wind that's happening in rural ministry. I better get going here, else time goes way too fast. So settle this matter of, and because here's the thing, there is a scorecard. There is a scorecard. The other side of this, and you'll hear two sides whenever I talk. I totally get that we're misunderstood, that we're not always appreciated, so on and so forth. But can we, having heard me say that, can we admit that a lot of times because of that, we check out and we're not working nearly as hard as we should be working? I know some rural pastors, God bless them, I'm not going to give their names, that sleep into 11. And if they want to take a day off, they can take a day off. If you're, you know what I'm saying? Not, you should have a day off. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I'm supposed to be working today. I don't feel like it. There's way too many churches that aren't realizing that there is a scorecard. So when I tell you, oh, you're not going to make that suburban scorecard, I'm not telling you to chill out. You hear what I'm saying? So anyway, so which gets to this next thing that I want to talk about is make tough calls with grace. We're going to get into this now. Let's just talk about this. If you really believe there's a scorecard and you really want to reach your community and you're in a traditional country church like the one that I walked into, there are some hard decisions that have to be made. And so I want to just begin with the first part of this. Make the tough calls. If there are, I mean, I came to a church where they were still singing some, you know, on a regular basis, singing hymns and nothing but hymns with an organ and piano. And listen, that has its place. We still sing hymns, at least like one a week. You know, we need to honor everybody, but we also did this thing in Sunday school where if it was your birthday, you came up and you put money in the bank and you got a pencil and just, there were some serious things. Any of you guys still doing that? Come on. Absolutely. As soon as I said it, I saw Dale over there smiling and I'm like, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, Dale. I didn't come to criticize that at all. But we had to make some very, and once again, I'm such a big believer that the inside job of the pastor ends up working itself out in the life of the church. If you don't make the tough calls, because they're hard to make in a rural setting. All right. You know, you can't get up. Like if you were in a big city church, you might have the hubris to say, you know, if you don't like what I'm doing, hit the road. There's more people that'll take your place. And you do always have to be willing to let people go, right? But you shouldn't promote that. You know what I'm saying? You're going to have to still buy groceries from that person and get your, so you have to handle things with grace. But that sometimes makes us in a position, puts us in a position where we don't make tough calls. And when you don't make tough calls, you either become depressed, passive aggressive, or you print your resume in time. If you know there's things that God is calling your church to do, you have to make the tough call. But you have to do it with grace. Amen. And my philosophy for the first 5 years, the people that attended Lamont Wesleyan Church when I got there, they all ended up in a new church. It was still called Lamont Wesleyan Church, but they were in a new church. It was so radically different. And my philosophy was to mourn with those who mourn. I remember Wayne Schmidt flew through Kansas City one time. It was around 2003. And we met and we were talking through this and he asked me, how have you managed all this? And I told him, I said, you know, I mourn with those who mourn. And here was my philosophy and it still is to an extent. I do it somewhat different. If I cannot sit down in the living room of an individual who's going to struggle with the decision I'm making and cry with them and explain to them why we're doing it. They're not going to agree necessarily, but be able to explain. If I can't do that, and if I can't recognize their pain, if I'm just going to roll my eyes at their pain, I'm not ready to make that decision. Until I own the pain of that decision, do I still need to do it? I absolutely do. And so here in 2 weeks, I've been there 18 years. I'm like the founding pastor. Honest to goodness, I could get up tomorrow and say, we're going to go a complete new direction. And, you know, 18 years, founding pastors can do that. But I don't walk away from this. This right here is what was there 18 years ago. And if I were to take a picture of this today, you wouldn't, I mean, like, there's a building that's right here now, a huge building. It's where we do most of our stuff. We've been doing some children's stuff and youth ministry in there. There's a group of people, around 25 people, that were there when I got there, many of whom got saved in that building. Okay? That building means a lot to them. And we have to tear it down. We have to tear it down. I mean, we just do. One, when we built this other building that you can't see now, I wish I'd have brought a picture of that, but it doesn't matter, but it's a huge building. We had to raise it up because the, you know, all you construction people would understand that. We brought in loads and loads and loads of dirt, and it ended up, we didn't do a great job with some of that, you know, with getting rid of some of that water, and it's just destroyed the foundation of that building. And it was a bad building to begin with, all right? I mean, it was like paneling and orange carpet and all this. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It was, some people had the Crystal Cathedral. We had a Timber Temple, you know, that type of thing. And it was falling apart. So in 2 weeks on Sunday after church, we've invited those people. And Pastor Andrew, his parents are here, by the way. Don, and thanks for being here. But Pastor Andrew Horbert is going to sit down with a guy who's an engineer in our community who's well known, and we're going to explain to this group, cry with them, that we're going to start planning a project. It'll be a year before it's done. We want to give them some time, but we're going to cry with them. We're going to make the tough call. All right. That's, you know, you want to make a tough call, tear down something like that, right? We're going to make the tough call, but we're going to make it with grace. Because for as many pastors who I see with passive-aggressive behavior, there are pastors with just aggressive behavior. And that just isn't going to fly in a world setting long-term, if you're going to thrive there long-term. You guys with me on that? All right, so up next, and I'm going to just get real personal for a while here. Since it's just us rural people in the room, let's first acknowledge that there's a lot of our friends who aren't here because they could have never afforded to be here. Okay? That isn't a criticism of this. This is the first time I've ever been to a gathering, or I've never been to a general conference, because very frankly, as a rural pastor, I can't afford. And many of the rural pastors that we minister to couldn't take time off work. Because co-vocation is the only way you can do it sometimes financially. Are you guys with me on that? Okay, so I understand that I'm speaking to those of us who are higher class within the rural ministry because we can afford to be here. Or our district gave us some money. You know, yeah, exactly. It took a little bit of all that for that to happen. Because like when there's a whole seminar that I do that compares an agrarian mindset to a suburban mindset in terms of business. And one of the differences is even if a church has money, they don't believe in paying hired hands any more than they have to. That's a agrarian concept. And so even if your church has some money, you probably are going to make less than a church that's in a white-collar area that has the very same financial dynamic. And many of us are just in situations that are desperate financially. Samantha and I were making my wife's back there. I should make her stand, but she'd shoot me. We were making $275 a week for the first 2 years with no health insurance. And one day, a deputy showed up at our house and handed me papers. Because we were getting sued over a medical bill. We had no idea because we were, I mean, part of the story, and we didn't have time to tell any of that story. I mean, I'm a city guy, okay? I mean, I was in Akron, Ohio, Lansing, Michigan. I mean, I'm a missionary now. I didn't realize that all that stuff was printed in that little paper that's the community paper so that if you get sued, if you get a speeding ticket, hey, country or city people don't realize this. Anything that happens to you legally, you buy a piece of land, everyone knows about it. You sneeze, it's in the social section, right? All right? And so Samantha actually had a lady say to her, we were talking about it last night, she said, boy, it's really tough. You know, we know it's sometimes hard to pay medical bills. And Sam's like, what are you talking about? Well, it was in the paper that we were being sued. All right? And were we financially irresponsible? I don't know. We went to movies every once in a while, which is something rural people didn't do, and that was seen as wasting money. Are you guys with me on this? I bring guys in from we're going to go see the movies. Please don't put it on Facebook yet, all right? Just realize that's seen as extravagance to the rural people that we deal with. All right, are we being real here? I mean, I'm sorry if you city guys, you can just check out a little bit. I know you don't understand what I'm talking about. I'm serious. You can get dinged for spending the wrong... I'm going to stop. Okay, so... But the only thing... I want to be really honest with you about this. And I have told them this. In 2003, we'd been there 3 years. The founding pastor of Lamont Wesleyan Church was a guy named H.K. Busby. His son, Dan, is known for church finances. And Dan saw what was going on. We had at that point... We had tripled, maybe quadrupled in attendance. And my salary had gone up from $275 to $325. Okay? And Dan came in. And he could come in. And not every rural church would have this. Because the other thing, we all know, right? Rural churches do not want experts to come in and tell us, like the EPA does, the size of our ponds and how many water sources we can have and all that. We don't need that, right? Stay away from us. But Dan was a hometown boy. And he worked them through what a real salary should look like. And if that had not happened, the story of Lamont would have never happened. Because as much as I was called there, we just could not make it. We were near bankruptcy. And we never did get rich. You know, I mean, it isn't, you know, you're just, but you've got to figure that out. I have just talking, I mean, some of you are on Facebook and you know, there's a pastor right now that's like communicating with me on Facebook about just they need a better job than a bus driving job because they just can't make ends meet. What I know, and I'm just going to lay this out here for you, is that most of the pastors that I see that have stayed long term, they have found a way to provide for themselves financially. For some of them, it's a spouse. Maybe their husband or maybe their wife has a good job. And so their spouse helps them and that provides for some of them. They have some kind of expertise and they have a good job in the community. You know, they have some kind of a project that they can do on the side. But the ones who are long-term are the ones who figure this out. And so when you go back home, realize most of the rural pastors that you're friends with, they're hurting financially, even if they won't admit it. And that's why you guys got to go see Mark Redeker. I mean, we'll help you through dirt roads with that. This Lilly Foundation thing, listen, they're going to go talk to your board, and they're going to say things to your board that you're not going to like, and you're going to have to be transparent. I've sat with Mark at a Starbucks one time, and it really felt awkward because Starbucks, right? And so, it's a very rigorous process to be a part of this Lilly Foundation deal, but it's helpful. It's helpful. So if you're gonna thrive, that's the subject I was given. If you're gonna thrive in a rural context, you've got to get that figured out. And I want to say it's tough as someone who's trying to raise up rural missionaries, because that's what we are. Okay, I didn't say that earlier. I need to come back to that, by the way. I don't care about rural pastoring anymore. We're rural missionaries. Okay, we are missionaries. If you're not a missionary, you don't belong in rural America. Okay, because rural America is darker than just about any place. You do know that, right? I'm off on a side tangent now. Is that okay? You do realize that if you're in rural America and you're a teenager, that you're twice as likely to be a drug abuser, twice as likely to commit suicide, and twice as likely to have a life of poverty in front of you as a suburban kid. Those are verifiable facts. As a matter of fact, if you're a rural person, I need to find out how to minister in my community, Go to the people who are ministering in urban areas and find out what they're doing, and then find a way to contextualize it. Because with gentrification and all that other stuff, am I the only one that's seen this in the last 18 years? All the people being forced out of inner cities are coming out where they can get rent in Madison, Kansas for $300, but then they find themselves separated by miles from government services. And they are sitting there poor as can be with no help. That's half of the towns that we minister to with Dirt Roads Network right now. I mean, they are messed up, and the drug use, it's the inner city. In fact, the Wall Street Journal in 2017 declared that rural America is the new inner city. It is. It absolutely is. And so even if, I mean, if you're going to deal, like people who do urban ministry, they struggle with finances, right? I mean, you have to go out and raise money, and we might be in that position. If we're really going to be effective. Yeah, real quick. Yeah. Yep. Here's what you need to know. You need to have the right leader behind that. You really do. And in a few minutes, I'm going to like come to something that will help you with this too. Because the outcome, if you have someone who's just dealt with suburban churches, I wouldn't trust them in that situation to deal with the board, because immediately an attitude will come out. Why are you being so conservative financially and not getting that? You know what I'm saying? But if nothing else, an opening of the eyes of your congregation to your financial needs. But the fact is that many of us, I mean, we're when it comes to this financial thing, some of this is going to be lowering our standards, because we're ministering to people who are poor. We're not ministering to suburban people who make $100,000, who come to something like this and the coffee better taste right. That's not who we're ministering to. And we don't need to be critical of that, because churches that do that kind of stuff for those people, they're being missionaries and they need to do that. But we're ministering to poor people. And for us to, you know, for us to try to force them into something, and you know, you have to be very careful there. But you, at the same time, they have to have their eyes open to that. And so it's the leadership that is behind, I think, that. And they'll learn a lot too. But if you have the right leader walking you through that, so figure out your finances, so that you can thrive, that you can thrive long term. And then this next one, I just really believe in. And there's a lot of things I've left out, and that's okay. But I wanted to talk about a few specific things today. And that is this issue of a sabbatical. I wanted to talk with you rural pastors about that as we talk about thriving. Let me begin by telling you what not to do. Because I've seen this. And it is, in my opinion, most sabbaticals for rural pastors are destructive. Okay, I just want you to think about that for a minute. You come here, you need to do a sabbatical every 7 years. I'm doing one every 10 years. Most sabbaticals for rural pastors are destructive. More often than not, when that pastor gets back, their ministry's about over. Okay? And the reason is that look at who we're ministering to. Some of us are ministering to agrarian farmers. When do they take a sabbatical? Others of us are in small communities where there's little factories and just like little industries. That when do those folks get a sabbatical? How many of them even know what that means? Are you guys with me on this? But it's vital, because if you're a rural church pastor, you're taxed more emotionally than like a multi-staff leader. I've been Lamont grew to the point where we had lots of staff. We have lots of staff now, but it's a different thing. They're all planting, and it's not really about the Lake Church. But it's less stressful to have a lot of staff emotionally. and you can create margin for yourself and all that kind of stuff. I believe rural pastors need, they really need sabbaticals. But it has to be carefully planned. My first sabbatical was in 2010. I'd been there, my only sabbatical, I better clarify. Probably in another year and a half, I'll get another one. But 2010, we started planning in 2008. And the first thing that we did is we spent a lot of time with the key leaders on the board. I want you to think about this level-wise. The key influencers on the board, we spent a good 2 or 3 months just talking to them. Because in the end, they were going to have to carry the water on this. Then it expanded out to the board. And all the questions, because there are, what is a sabbatical? Why does a pastor need to go on a sabbatical? Isn't it like a long vacation? You know, all these types of questions. Are you guys with me on this? A year before I went on the sabbatical was the first time it was announced, and it wasn't announced by me, it wasn't in the bulletin, it was the board getting up on the stage and saying, we have studied this, we want our pastor to be healthy, you all know that you call him or her, whatever the case would be, whenever you have an emotional issue you're going through, and they carry those burdens for us. And we want them to do that well. So we are insisting, and this is the language that was used from the platform, we are insisting that Steve go on a sabbatical so that he can minister effectively. And every one of them was prepared to answer privately what that was about. So that by the time I went on sabbatical, now there were other understandings that you need to have. I agreed I wasn't looking for another job. I wasn't going to resign for 3 years. And I mean, they weren't going to fire me when I got back and all that kind of stuff. And we took a lot of effort to make sure. I mean, I talked Joanne Lyon into coming and speaking, you know, and a bunch of other people that were, I mean, so we tried to make it an exciting thing for the church. But I want to tell you how many times I've seen a pastor who's burned out, a leader comes in, whether it's a network leader or a district leader, you need a sabbatical, your pastor's going on sabbatical, people who've never heard of that term, who never get it, when that pastor comes back, they actually resent that they got a break. And it's a lack of knowledge that puts them in that position. Now I want to tell you what we did poorly. As I went over this with my wife, you know, I started telling her what I was going to share today. She says, you need to tell them the whole truth. And okay, what we did poorly is we had no money back then. We made no financial provision for ourselves. We ended up like staying at my mom and dad's house for a couple weeks. And we had no money to do anything. So it wasn't nearly as effective as it could have been. So those are some things that you need to do to thrive, to really thrive in rural ministry, I think, is to settle this matter of calling and understand you're a missionary. But what I wanted to have a little space to talk to you about is this, is that I believe there's a fresh wind that's blowing across rural America right now. Everywhere I go, there are pastors who have caught a new vision. I think that there's a realization that we are in a mission field now, and that there are lost people all around us, everywhere you look. And I just want to say to you, if God has put that fire in your heart, don't worry about the scorecard anymore. Just walk away from the scorecard. Don't worry about building your lake anymore. And instead, decide how you're going to reach your community and how you're going to reach the community down the road And even if you're a church of 50, you can plant another church. You know that, right? You know? I mean, we every little community has its own expression. And if you're willing to walk away from that scorecard and walk into the concept of being a missionary, there's a tremendous harvest out there. I believe if you look at our history as a denomination and as a movement, it always started in rural areas. Our history is rural going into the cities. And so even though we might miss this, this move of God that I believe is taking place in our denomination, didn't you feel that last night? And there's just been a shift in what God is doing in our denomination. I believe we can be the torchbearers for that. That's why there's going to be a Dirt Roads Network. It's still a lot of aspirational stuff. We haven't done it all yet. But I believe we are the ones who can bring a renewal to our denomination that walks away from a scorecard that no longer works. It hurts us. That scorecard hurts. Even the big city churches, it hurts. They're so busy in maintaining that they're missing that culture is leaving us. You know, we are the ones. We're small enough and we see the need. We're close enough to the people. We can see it and we can own the fact that we can change this country and our denomination. Are you guys with me on this? I believe this. We are the ones that can introduce a new scorecard to them by showing what we can do in rural America by getting serious about the fact that we're missionaries. That's what I want for you. And I think for many of us, do you know what we need? We just need someone to blow wind in our sails and say, it's okay. It's okay. You might not have a huge church. Do you have an effective church? Is your community being changed because of you? Are you raising up leaders who are going to go out to community? Are you doing the work of a missionary? And if you are, who cares about that statistical report? I'm serious. There is a move of the Spirit that needs to happen. You know, every single year, 1% more of America checks that no religious affiliation box. And I'm worried about the size of my church? Seriously, I'm worried about, is that really what I'm worried about? We can set the standard for a new way of doing ministry. And so it's going to take, you got to figure some of this out. For some of you, just buy into the fact you're going to be bivocational the rest of your life. And turn that into your ministry. You know, if John Maxwell can do it on that scale, surely you can do it on a 50-50 scale, right? I'm being serious, right? Own it. I'm bivocational. Do you know what? You're a hero. You're a missionary. I better stop. But anyway, because I'm supposed to give you 15 minutes to ask questions. And that's what they told me. So that's where we are. Question and answer time. So, I'm going to just let you ask questions. Go ahead.
Thinking of the video we seen yesterday morning, I think about the guy that was in ministry and went burnt out and then went into the carpentry.
Yes.
And then went into the camp director. I look at that picture of the success.
Yes.
Most people would say, well, he failed as a pastor. But I see it as a success because he didn't fail.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I want to say again, because this is absolutely vital. There are two sides to that coin. One side is that we can somehow feel we're a failure because there's expectations that we have bought into and we're not meeting them. And I see that being destructive. But let's also own, now we're in this room, so we are probably people who aren't a part of this, but let's also own, even within our denomination, there are a lot of rural churches and rural pastors who've checked out. And that scorecard don't work, so we're having no scorecard, just leave us alone. And I want to be very clear, whenever I say one, that I say the other. Because it's the same coin. If you're going to reject this scorecard, grab a different scorecard. You following me? So yeah, he was a success. I agree with you. Yep. Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of us, a lot of relevant. But how do you, when you are in a rural context like that, and you are the pastor in the community, and that can be a real pitfall, how do you avoid that?
Yeah, those heart issues, Satan's going to fight you one way or the other. I mean, he's just going to push you one way or another. And in the end, that's a one-on-one thing with God of humility. And for me, God keeps me humble. I mean, the minute I get arrogant about anything, I'm left out hanging. But just acknowledging it is the first step. But I want to say this, because I mean you've heard me speak numerous times, I think. Own the fact that you are the pastor of that community, not with pride, but with responsibility. You know, that's something you should shoulder with a spiritual humility. It doesn't mean you're all that in a bag of chips, but we have greater influence in our communities than even megachurch pastors do. I bet you Kevin Meyer has never been called by the superintendent of schools to ask if it's okay if they reschedule a Christmas program to a Wednesday night because of a snowstorm. I have. You know what I'm saying? And a lot of you that are rural pastors, you have too, right? Yeah, well, maybe not, but that's, I mean, you know, that's, yeah. Own that. So, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Want our churches to grow.
We
should be satisfied. I'm kind of sort of in a rural community from where I just came from.
Right.
Where I just have taken on purpose my new assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And I did what I did on purpose.
Right.
I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But even though it's a much, much smaller congregation, I want that congregation that I'm now serving in, have the privilege of serving it. I don't want them to stay at 100. Okay, I want to mm-hmm. enlarge that to the best of my ability. Is there any way you can tell us how you have done what you have done so that we might chew on it a little
yeah.
bit, think about it, and see if we can implement any of these things that you've done to be successful in that rural community that you're serving?
Yeah, I want to
do it.
Yeah,
go from 25 to
300 or whatever it was. That's a challenging question for me right now to answer because I'm still processing whether or not I did the right thing. Yes. I really believe that there are two major components to local rural church growth. And these are big principles, all right? Big principles, and there may be more. One of them is you truly have to be a loving church. Okay, let's just, you might not expect me to go there, but I'm telling you there are a lot of rural churches that are not loving churches. And I'm not talking about on Sunday morning. When you're a rural place, the way you act on Monday morning, everybody knows. And you have to be a truly loving group of people. I want to tell you, Lamont Wesleyan Church, you want to know why it's growing? Why it's done what it's done is because we are loving. And then the second thing is that every change that we've made, major change that we've made, has come out of prayer, not strategizing. And I've shared this with other folks, and some of you in Indiana, I think Indiana South, I probably shared this the most with. But our model, when we were right at the beginning of this, our church went through Blackaby's Experiencing God. And there's things about that maybe, you know, I'm not a formula person, but the principle behind that has influenced everything. We do not make major decisions without major times of prayer. And I'm talking about the congregation coming together, and it might only end up being 30 to 40% of them, which is still a pretty high number, spending hours in prayer together before we do anything major. And it changes everything because then it's a surrender to God, and then it's successful because it is God. And I know that what we want is change the music and all that kind of stuff. And I agree that may be what God calls you to do because there's lots of obstacles that we put. I mean, if we're just honestly, you know, in a rural church, there's a lot of obstacles that stop God from moving because there's traditions and things that we do that just make it difficult for a person who's on church to come. But if the passion behind it isn't prayer and God told us to do this, we've got 8 minutes now, God's given us a passion to do this, then it isn't going to work anyway. And so you have to be a loving church and a prayerful church. And that sounds old time, but I'm telling you, it's the only thing that works. Go ahead.
Steve, my only contention there is, I think every rural church, just about, you were to ask them, they said, oh man, we're the most loving church.
That is true, because we're nice to each other.
Right, exactly. And so I think maybe a word there that we use is non-judgmental.
Yeah.
So people come with their messes.
Absolutely.
Warmly received, because we're great at loving you.
Yeah.
But them? I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah. So let me brag on the guy next to you for just a minute. I preached at Doug's church, Doug Preston, Lifeline Church. And I'm sitting there. They have a Celebrate Recovery program. And I'm walking in, and some of this you're not going to like, Doug, okay? I just don't like the Gaithers. Okay, that's all right. Just so you know that. I lived down the road from Alexandria or wherever it is for a while. But I'm looking around. I'm looking around the church. I spoke there. And there are some blue hairs there. And there are some people that it's very clear that they're right out of Celebrate Recovery and everything in between. And those folks were loving on each other. Okay? They were loving on each other. And the Spirit of God was in that place. And they sang a song that I don't like for 10 minutes. And I stood there crying because, I mean, I'm watching people all tatted up going to the altar and these old ladies going up and praying around them. Okay? And I'm telling you, there's a lot of rural churches that if you come in and you're tatted up, are you kidding me? And so when I say love, I do mean that non-judgmental. You can come, I mean, we've had people come in, we've had people that are getting divorced that actually write on their schedules which one gets to come which week so that they don't have to sit next to each other. And we love them both. But I would say that love, unconditional love, Richard, I appreciate you bringing that in because I just assume that, yeah. But every church loves each other. I mean, well, okay. The ones that don't eventually plant another church. Which can I take a few minutes and just talk about this? Guys, do you realize how many small towns there are that do not have an evangelical, life-giving church? I was talking to a couple just yesterday. I won't call them out. I know. I'm standing close to them. You go up to Nebraska? I mean, in Kansas, I mean, do you guys know how big Kansas is? We have like 40 churches. Okay, I mean, there's gotta be, and Nebraska's worse. There's communities all around us that have no, I mean, and as the United Methodist Church continues to go down the road that it's going down, I mean, we have to be raising up rural missionaries. Can I go on that for a minute, Randy? Would that be okay? There are people in your church that have great skills. They're going to be great bivocational pastors someday in that town 20 miles from you. We need to accept that as a form of church planting. Dwight Nash talks about rhinos and rabbits. Have you guys ever heard Dwight talk about that? Like rhinos, I mean, the gestational period is like a year or something like that. Rabbits, it's like a day. I don't know how that works. As rural communities, we're sort of rabbits, you know what I mean? We're smaller. What if every one of us decided to plant a church, no matter how small church our church was? I mean, if Lamont, okay, we're involved in three, okay? If Lamont can plant churches, anybody can. I really believe that. If a town of 28 can be planting churches, then you can too. But you've got to get rid of the lake mentality that's even there with your small little pond. That, you know, anyone can be a big fish if they find a small enough pond, right? So, you know, you have to be, guys, we got to do that. And I'm just going off now, so I'll stop. What other questions? I have time for, like... Oh, I used to do that? Oh, I used to think I was the hero. Oh, my goodness. You guys, some of you guys that have heard me speak before. I mean, literally, we tried multi-site. Okay, we went from a church alive is worth the drive, and we're really arrogant because you're leaving your unsaved friends, but you're driving 40 miles one way to see us. Okay, so that was our model for the first 9 years. Then we began to shift into multi-site because we saw that, literally, we did see that people were not bringing their unsaved friends. And it got to the point where on a Sunday morning, you know, I get to drive over and speak to this large crowd in Neustrand, and then literally they put the sermon at the beginning of the, you know, there's three songs. I get up, I preach, I get in the car, because this is country life. I drive back to the service that's already started and I come in and preach. And you know what that was? That was, even though it wasn't intentional, that was about me. Okay. My job is to raise up people. So we do not do satellites anymore. I'm not criticizing anyone who does, but I want to tell you there's a number of us pastors that used to be into satellite that we feel God is calling us. And I'm talking about a national shift and small and large that satellites are maybe something that God used, but maybe it's a lot more effective to raise up a leader and plant a church rather than planting a satellite. And for us, any satelliting we do from now on will be to plant if we do satellite. Like if one of our staff members preaches there, it's going to be so that it becomes its own independent church. Yes. Oh my goodness. How much time do we have? Okay, so let's talk about dreams now, okay? Let's talk about dreams. Because what are the things that, okay, we used to have circuit riders. Oh my goodness, Jimmy Dodd's going to kill me because he wants to get right in here for this next seminar. We used to have circuit riders because all you needed for a church, okay, now we're just going to blow our minds. Okay, let's just talk about this. All you needed for a church was a preacher, okay? Now you need an effective children's ministry, youth ministry, and worship. Why can't that be circuit? Why couldn't you plant four churches at once and sort of have it go around different weeks? And I mean... and put a youth ministry in the center of all of that. Okay, anyway, I'm going to shut up. Okay, because, but seriously, I believe that we have to start thinking in those types of ways to where, and there are youth ministries, for example, if you go to Hillsdale County, Michigan, Crossroads Farm, that is in the middle of a field and it does youth ministry for miles around. It's the youth ministry for a number of rural pastors and rural churches. What if we planted five or six churches all at once with centralized youth ministry? And okay, now this is out of the box stuff that I haven't done yet. All right, it's not done yet. But what if you had a floating worship team and you had missional communities that met on the other Sundays? They come together for a meal and they were, I mean, a true missional community. And maybe once or twice a month they have the live worship there and all that kind of stuff. Okay, some of you are like, okay, this guy just lost me. We were doing really good. But if we're going to be mission, isn't that the type of thing a missionary would do?
Yeah.
So we have to lead the charge with that kind of unconventional thinking. Because we're small enough, we can do it. I mean, let's take the fact that we're agile and use it to our advantage. And lead the way for our denomination. It actually forces us to equip God's people for the ministry. Yeah. It really, if I'll be honest with them, you're training to be a nurse? No, you're not. You're training to be a pastor in a hospital. I mean, you know, I mean, that's, yeah. So, oh my goodness, here we go. Do you want to have a seminar over in another building and I just keep going? You don't want to do that. Can I pray for you guys? Real quick. Yes, Randy?
You mentioned Larry Wachmeyer a few times.
Yes.
A book on the lake.
Yes.
River called Flow. And it's a free resource on the
exponential. Yeah. I really recommend that book because Larry comes from our tradition. He's a Free Methodist, Larry Wachmeyer. If you go to Exponential, the book Flow, it's a free PDF. And I really, really recommend it. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we believe that you have poured your Spirit out on rural America. We just believe that. And Father, you have called many Wesleyan rural pastors to a new way of thinking. And Lord, I believe you want that to spread across our entire denomination. So Father, I pray in the name of your Son, Jesus, that the thing that you've started would just flow to every person in this room. And that we would accept that mantle of missionary. And that we would transform rural America as we become missionaries for you. In Jesus' name, amen.